From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 20th day of May, 2021. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Matt Bennett. He's at agmarket.net. And we'll hear a story about farmstress.org. This is a new collaborative website across 12 states in the Corn Belt, but housed here on the Urbana-Champaign campus at the University of Illinois, that's aimed at helping producers deal with stress on the farm, especially mental stress. We'll hear more about that, and we'll take a look, too, at the weather forecast. Speaking of stressful, that with Mike Tenora from T-Storm Weather in Chicago on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. This quick note before we get to the numbers, Illinois Extension is looking for a full-time farm mechanic to be based at the Ewing Demonstration Center. That's in the southern part of the state. There's a May 31 application deadline, and you can find the details on our website at willag.org, willag.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Nearby corn, July contract at 644.5 today, finished up 6.25 cents. September at 579, 12 higher in December. 552 up 13. Soybeans, losers for the day, down a nickel in the lead July at 1533.25. The August contract, $14.80.25, down 5.25. November soybeans, $13.67.75, a penny and a half lower for the day. Bean meal futures at 401.10. Down 2.10 in the bean oil at 65.76, 71 cents lower. Hard red July wheat finished the contract at 6.25, down 8.75 in the soft red at 6.75.25, down 4 cents on the afternoon. Live cattle futures were off 30, the feeders were $1.80 lower, and lean hogs were up $1.30. Matt Bennett at AgMarket.net now joins us to discuss what happened in Chicago. Better day today, Matt, than it was yesterday. Can I review that with you very quickly? The initial thought, and I think this is right, is that the drop had to do with the big losses in Bitcoin. Is that something you think really happened? And how did corn manage to make its comeback?
You know, I think that spilled over. There was definitely a huge devaluation in the cryptocurrency market. I think another thing that was, you know, going on is as people watch this Kansas wheat tour, you know, the crop obviously looks like it could be pretty big. I mean, they came out today and said it could be the biggest in 19 years. But, you know, some of that weakness in the wheat market yesterday kind of spilled over. Then, of course, soybeans were getting absolutely hammered. And so all that weakness, in my opinion, you know, the corn market had a decent little week going earlier on. Some of the soybean weakness on Tuesday, I think, spilled over. I think some of it spilled over again on Wednesday. And so you come in here this morning, you get another sale. It's 9 out of 10 days that we've had a sale to China, you know, a surprise announcement, if you will. Of course, export sales for next marketing year were huge, you know, and we get a little bit of a rebound in here. And I think that makes pretty good sense whenever you stop and think of what kind of demand we've uncovered.
But just very quickly, those who want to catch up on the wheat tour, if they've not been following along, they can do that on our website. It has wrapped up, by the way. It lasted 3 days this week, and there's a live feed from Twitter there. I'll leave that up probably through tomorrow morning. It does have the final numbers on it. 58.1 bushel to the acre for the Kansas wheat tour. They take in a bit more than Kansas, but hard red winter wheat area. And you're right, that is the highest tour average going all the way back to the year 2000. Because the Kansas winter wheat crop is located in Kansas, along with the beef production areas of the United States, does it make a difference? I mean, it will be fed to cattle instead of corn, I suppose.
There's no doubt wheat's going to be fed. It's already being fed. You know, some of the folks I talked to out in Kansas and Nebraska have told me wheat has worked its way into the rations. It definitely makes sense. I mean, heck, whenever you look at, you know, just for instance, comparing something like the price of U.S. corn out on the world market, it's the most expensive feed grain there is. So cash corn certainly has climbed to a level to force some of these feed yards, you know, to consider ulterior methods to be able to put the gains on their cattle. And so I guess at this stage of the game, if you have a huge wheat crop, which you're still going to be needing some good weather, you know, to finish this thing out, then it's certainly going to at least alleviate some of the potential stress. But moving forward, I think the main thing people are going to be looking very closely at is just how much does the safrinha crop get hurt, first of all. You know, and then second of all, what kind of acreage are we looking at here? Because if you go to adding 5 or 6 million acres, like some people have suggested, it would change things dramatically. I just don't know where you find all those acres.
Yeah, so there was a suggestion earlier in the week that some of them may come out of cotton as it continued to rain for a lengthy period of time in the south. And they've not been able to put that particular crop in the ground. They could, I suppose, go to corn there. But it would be hard to find 5 million acres plus find a, you know, 100 or 500,000 of soybean too, I think.
Yeah, I think so. And the other thing is, you know, we say at the most maybe a 500,000 acres from cotton to corn. But, you know, if you're going to be too wet early on and then try to switch over to corn in that part of the world, you're going to be pollinating in an extremely hot time. And so it definitely poses some issues. The other thing is we've talked about many times, Todd, you know, there's a whole host of crops that have been trying to vie for acreage this year. And so being able to come up with 5 million acres might be a stretch. I'm not saying it can't happen, but I certainly don't. I certainly wouldn't be betting a whole lot of money that that's going to happen. Right now, I'm probably going to be in that, oh, I don't know, 2 to 3 million acre pickup. I think you could get up to 94 maybe, but I just don't see you getting over that. I think that would be the absolute most I'd be willing to go. And so whenever you start plugging in the kind of demand we've seen, you kind of understand, you know, looking at ethanol numbers. I mean, we're probably going to have to up the ethanol number for this old crop. And you know, you're just looking at a really good situation moving forward, which could certainly put you put the USDA in the frame of mind that they're going to have to not only adjust old crop carry out, they're probably going to have to adjust new crop exports significantly if the Chinese continue on this buying spree.
So you're thinking that things could move to the upside. I did make note on your Twitter feed this week. You reminded farmers they thought $5 was a good cash price when it passed that on the way up for new crop. What should they do, if anything?
Yeah, I mean, what I'm saying is, Todd, is I think if you don't have ideal weather, there's definitely a potential upside in this market. But as my tweet suggested, you know, we were all pretty thrilled to see $5 corn as the market rallied. You start running the numbers, you see what profit margins look like there, just at normal yields, you know, and you get pretty excited. And that's the whole point, is that as a producer, you got to run those numbers. And so that's what I think we got to be doing is, you know, where are we sitting out on sales? What percentage are we at? You know, if you've got a full stand and things look good and you've got a full soil moisture profile, certainly pushing your sales another 10% isn't going to hurt anything. I want to stay flexible. Just due to the volatile nature of this market, but at the same time, locking in income levels that we can see, you know, whenever December corn is trading above 550, boy, those are some pretty salty levels, and I don't think we should be ignoring them. So I certainly want to get anywhere from 25 to 50% sold at this time, but again, I want to keep flexibility and certainly, you know, on that second 25% that we're marketing, because by all means, this crop's far from being made. I don't know about you guys, didn't get as much moisture as we did, but we had between 4 and 5 inches this week, probably going to have a few ponds, but our crop still looks pretty darn good, maybe as good as what it's looked in several years.
What do you make of the soybean market?
Well, the soybean market's definitely been under some pressure this week. You know, people keep calling and saying, why would beans be going down whenever we've got such a tight situation, old and new? You know, and I sit here and remind them to look at the board, and we're 1532 on July beans and 1366 on November beans. And quite frankly, yeah, it's a friendly situation as far as bullish stocks. Yeah, and stocks of usage, no doubt about it, but how bullish can you get at these price levels? And so you got to continue to come up with bullish information to be able to push the market to even higher highs. And so I wouldn't say that I'm necessarily bearish in here. I just think that a producer, you know, if they're frustrated about the market being at 1366, they need to take a reality check, because this is an extremely profitable price. It's something that we haven't experienced and been privy to for several years. And we got to take a step back and you know, and consider how fortunate we are instead of being frustrated we're a barrel off the highs.
Hey, thank you.
Absolutely, thank you.
That's Matt Bennett. He's with AgMarket.net. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Find us online. Listen to us on demand anytime you'd like at willag.org. That's willag.org. Just click and play right there from the website. Scroll down the page and you'll find information from the agricultural economist, crop scientist, and animal scientist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I, and an update of the latest agricultural news. If you keep going, you'll find podcast applications from which you can listen to the programming as well. Places like Stitcher, SoundCloud, NPR One, Spotify, Google Podcast, and Apple Podcast too. Now up next, Ryan Denham from WGLT out of Bloomington Normal spoke with a couple of extension specialists here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Courtney Cuppertson and Josie Rodolfi are maintaining a website called farmstress.org. It's a 12-state collaborative that Cuppertson said is aimed at the mental health of agricultural participants like farmers.
There's a lot of research that has demonstrated that mental health among people in agricultural communities is unfortunately worse than that of the general population, and for a lot of different reasons. For example, studies have shown that rates of depression among agricultural communities can be around from 6 to 50%, whereas with the general population in the U.S., it's closer to around 7%. When we are thinking about things like anxiety, within the general population, that's at about 16%, but among agricultural communities, it's more like 27 to 71%.
Why would there be differences between agricultural communities and the general population?
So we think about agriculture as an occupation. There are some really unique characteristics that undoubtedly contribute to stress. So we talk to producers, or we survey producers. Common stressors that emerge are things related to commodity prices, commodity markets, much larger political economic situations, both of which the producer has very little control over. Similarly, we talk about weather certainly emerges as a concern. I'm constantly worried about too much or too little rainfall, too cold or too hot of environments for crops to grow. Again, something that producers have very little control of. So when we compare agriculture to some other occupations, while there are some similarities, especially among people who are perhaps small business owners, what we notice is that so much of what farmers experience is completely out of their control. And so managing those stressors becomes a little bit more challenging.
So how has COVID-19 added to the stressors you just rattled off there?
Courtney and I actually did a survey of agricultural producers in the Midwest last summer to try to understand what their COVID-19 experience has been. Producers communicated issues like worrying about markets for their livestock specifically, and not sure what they're going to do if they can't get their, you know, the livestock that they're feeding to market, and other issues related to supply chain pressures, so not being able to get inputs when they needed them. Keep in mind, COVID-19 really emerged in the spring. We know spring is a very busy time for agricultural producers in the Midwest. And then, of course, we heard concerns about COVID-19 in general, being able to keep them and their families healthy, trying to imagine what would happen if they were to get sick, who would do the work, again, during this very busy time, and how do we keep employees safe and healthy? We know there's a lot of seasonal or temporary work that's hired in the spring and the fall in those peak agricultural periods, and wondering what I can do on my farm to make sure that we keep everyone healthy while still getting done our essential tasks.
There is still a stigma around mental health, and that stigma may prevent some people from seeking help if they have anxiety or depression or anything else. How does that stigma play out in agricultural communities?
That's a really good question. We certainly think stigma still contributes to perhaps some people's hesitancy to reach out to get help. And that's really why the North Central Farm and Ranch Stress Assistance Center has made available resources and services to meet a producer where they are. If somebody prefers getting information online, we have our clearinghouse website. If people prefer anonymous helplines, we're supporting a number of those in the North Central region, specific states, and then also regionally.
The state of Illinois and the country overall has struggled at times to invest what's needed in mental health care services, even in big cities where there are a ton of people and a ton of mental health practitioners. Are mental health resources just more limited in the rural places where farmers live and work typically?
Unfortunately, yes, they are. The federal government has a designation called Health Professional Shortage Area, and they do actually parse this out to look specifically at mental health providers. And when we look at maps of what this looks like across the state of Illinois, most of these mental health professional shortage areas are in more rural areas. Now, obviously, also there are people in urban agriculture and urban farmers, and we know that they're just in general in the United States are not enough mental health providers. And that's part of the reason that we want to empower community members to feel like there are things that they can do. Even if they can't access a mental health professional, there are ways that we can be supportive of those around us until such a time that someone's able to get access to a professional.
Yeah, I think the other two barriers we often encounter are, of course, affordability. So if insurance doesn't cover it, is that something that producers or anybody is willing to front the cost for? And then the other is acceptability. Producers specifically say, everyone knows my truck in town. And if I'm parked outside behavioral health specialist office, people are going to know and people are going to talk. And what will that mean for me and my family in this community? So acceptability, really speaks to stigma that we perceive is still alive and well in some of our more rural communities.
That was University of Illinois Extension Specialist Josie Ridolfi. She and Courtney Cuthbertson spoke with Ryan Denham from WGLT out of Bloomington Normal about farmstress.org. That's the website they maintain for a 12-state collaborative across the Corn Belt. On this Thursday afternoon, we're joined by Mike Tenura. He's at T-Storm Weather in Chicago. Mike, thank you for being with us. It's a warmer and sunnier day here. I'd like to come back to that. But let's start in a place where it's been warmer and sunny for a long time. Can you tell me about the drought in Brazil and how it has progressed over the last several weeks?
Well, nothing's changed over the last several weeks because it hasn't rained very much. So it's only gotten worse over that period of time. The interesting thing is that if you look at the southern third to southern half of corn in Brazil, most of it was planted by about the middle to second third of March. And over that period of time, we've had no rain. A lot of these areas have not received any rain in more than 70 days. Now, there is rain coming up for the first time in a long time, starting up this weekend and then continuing on and off over the 7 to 10 days that follow. So we are looking at 1 to 3 inches for this southern corn area. But you need to keep a couple of things in mind. Number one, 2.5 inches of rain is average for the next 2 weeks. So even when we say 1 to 3 inches of rain, it's only typical for this period of time coming up. And the second thing to keep in mind is that it's essentially August in U.S. terms for the corn crop. And as you know, once you get rains in August, it's a little bit later than when you really need them. So if it hasn't rained for most of June and most of July, and then you finally start getting some rains in August, you would come to the conclusion that it's probably too late to make for a major improvement. And that's pretty much what our opinion is at this point, and just especially with some of the dryness numbers that we have here. I mean, if you look at the proportion of corn in Brazil that had less than a quarter of its normal rainfall over the last 60 days, it's at 41%. That's telling you a huge chunk of corn has received very little to no rain over the last 2 months. And even over the last 90 days, it's hovering at about 12% of production. So try to imagine 12% of your corn crop basically getting little to no rain for 90 days right in the key part of the growing season. Obviously, that's not going to do very well. And now we're just going to start measuring exactly what happened.
Is there much of a difference as you go northward into Brazil, into the primary production areas of Mato Grosso, for instance?
Well, it certainly improves as you start to move northward. The only catch is that parts of Goiás and southeast Mato Grosso, which is about 20 to 25% of corn production, they've been kind of in that transition zone between decent rains up to the north and then the severe dryness off to the south. So it doesn't automatically change from this what you would consider a very bad situation to suddenly a very good situation. The very good situation is probably limited to about 10 to 20% of the crop, but that transition zone there in between with around another 20 to say 30%, not in an ideal setup, and then the rest of it looking pretty poor. So yes, it does improve as you go northward, but it's not a marked transition. It's a rather gradual transition.
In North America, how do you view the drought in the northern plains into the Canadian prairies?
Well, it's pretty bad. If you just look at how much of the crop has been, or at least expected spring wheat crop has been drier than normal over the last 6 months, it's at 85% of production. Our proprietary data goes back to 2015, and there's no day in the growing season that's anywhere close to this in at least the last six seasons. Most of the time, that number is pretty close to 0%, and we're way up there, including most of the crop. Now, there are rains on the way over the next 5 to 7 days, and some pretty decent rains at that. We think they'll be around 1 to 1.5 inches across much of the spring wheat belt over the next week. And so that will certainly improve topsoil moisture, but it won't change that 180-day drought scenario all that much. And that tells us that we're going to need more rain after this. Now, if it just keeps on raining every few days going forward through June and July, then maybe this drought won't have been as bad as it could have been. But if this is just a one-off type of rain situation, and then we move back into the drier period at the end of the month and into June, it will quickly turn back into a story, because given how dry it is now, one rain, two rains, even three rains isn't going to fix this problem. It just pretty much needs to rain through the rest of the season.
So you don't think it's a pattern change?
Well, at this point, it's certainly a near-term pattern change. But once we get beyond this period, the concern that we have is that if you look at similar La Niñas to the one that just ended and to the situation that we're going into, two of the three that are most similar to the one that we're in now were much drier than normal in June and July. So that would tell you that the drought very well might continue. On the other hand, one of those years was a little wetter than normal, so maybe it would end. But it just is the kind of situation where you don't want to look at the weather maps and say, oh, I can see it's going to rain for 1 to 2 weeks, even though we've been in a drought for 6, 7, 8, 9 months, and now it's over. It's just too early to start thinking that way.
What about in the Eastern Corn Belt?
Well, the Eastern Corn Belt's been a little bit wet, but they're drying out now. You can see outside that it's certainly warmed up a lot in recent days, and we have upper-level high pressure that's developing. So it will dry out a lot over the next 5 to 7 or 8 days, and that will improve conditions for planting in the Eastern Corn Belt and even into Kentucky and Tennessee. After that, it turns a little bit stormier once we get into the second half of next week, and then maybe even lasting into Memorial Day weekend. That's primarily because the jet stream is going to strengthen as we get some cooler air off to the north, and that should set up a transition zone between cool air to the north and warm air to the south, which is typically a recipe for some storms. So we don't think the dry period that's coming up is going to last, at least not for much more than the next week.
Hey, thank you.
Yep, great being here.
That's Mike Tenere. He's with T-Storm Weather in Chicago. Joined us on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report. Came to you from Illinois Public Media.